to work.
Come on, one more time together. Merry Christmas, baby.
Present. Richmond and all the pretty girls. Oh, la 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 la. That's for my old brother, and all the soul fans. Christmas brethren, baby. Here we go. Come on, let me hear you. Come on. All right. Now listen to me. Somewhere in this big wide world, there's some little girl and boy who's wishing for a great big Christmas, maybe one, two, or three toys. But sadly enough, believe me as it seems, they won't get these things, we know. But the best that we can do is wish a Merry Christmas to you and hope next year things will have a lot of joy. Christmas presents for everyone.
Children are fast asleep. It's time for Santa Claus to make his midnight creep. 'Cause Santa Claus wants some loving. Santa Claus wants some loving. I know it's something real pretty underneath that Christmas tree. Seem to find my pliers. I'm halfway watching Mama before she get that sleep in her eyes. 'Cause Santa Claus wants some loving. Santa Claus wants some loving. Everybody got their stocking, I hang it upside the wall.
for Santa Claus. When Christmas morning come around, my work is all through. You see, Santa Claus wants some too. Santa Claus got to have some too. I'll be so glad when Christmas morning comes. The kiss and hug. Now I know Santa Claus, he got a job to do. But Santa Claus is only human. Santa Claus wants some too. Soon as Christmas morning comes, my work is all through. I'm going home because Santa Claus wants some too. Santa Claus got to have some too, y'all.
Santa's gotta have some too, y'all.
I ain't had no loving since way back first of all. But soon as Christmas morning come around, I'm going home to make love to Miss Santa Claus. Because Santa Claus wants some too, y'all. Santa Claus wants some too. Santa Claus needs Santa Claus wants some too. 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 Santa Claus got to have some too. I ain't been home, y'all, so way back first of all. Go home to Miss Santa Claus. Because Santa Claus wants some too, y'all. Santa Claus got to have some too. See, you know, everybody seems to think that Santa Claus don't need no love. But you know, Santa Claus only human. He like to kiss and make love. I declare.
All right, well, we had quite a variety of folks in this last set as well to bring us up to the top of the hour, where I always remind you that you're listening to the WRCT Pittsburgh. Kevin Amos here for you on a Sunday, 1-1, Christmas Eve in 2023, playing some sounds that you probably never heard before. I'm quite sure of it. And if you have, you're right on with me. Yeah. All right. Santa Claus wants some loving. Yes, indeed. Mr. Bobby Rush there for you. Yeah. Santa Claus wants some loving. Also, Wooten Brothers in there. Charles Wright. Man, Wooten Brothers, Charles Wright, and a few other folks here as we pull up our menu like we always do because I can't read this stuff. Solomon Burke. Also, Tinsley Ellis. Santa Claus Wants Some Loving from Tinsley Ellis and Bobby Rush doing Santa Claus Wants Some Too. And that brings us up to the top of the hour. as we say, WRCT Pittsburgh, www.wrct.org. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be.
Over the past few years, the COVID-19 pandemic has affected how we live our daily lives.
Today, one in five Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges, but many of us do not understand what we are facing or how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we work every day to eliminate stigma, combat mental illness and substance use disorders, and advance mental health.
If you or someone you love needs help, you are not alone. Please visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
Medicaid and CHIP offer free or low-cost health coverage for children and teens. Hospital and doctor visits, prescriptions, shots, and more are covered. That's peace of mind for parents if a child is sick or gets injured. And parents may now be eligible for Medicaid, too, even if they've applied in the past. Enrollment is always open. Visit InsureKidsNow.gov or call 1-877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
I just had another dizzy spell and almost fell. I'm scared they will get worse and never go away.
You're not alone. 69 million people suffer from dizziness and vertigo.
I wonder if there's help.
There is. The Vestibular Disorders Association has a helpline at 800-837-8428 or visit liferebalanced.org.
Can you repeat that?
800-837-8428 or liferebalanced.org.
Sponsored by the Vestibular Disorders Association.
Reach the eye.
So, if you're outside of our coverage area, remember, you can listen to WRCT online. Live streaming available at www.wrct.org. WRCT Pittsburgh. You have no excuse not to listen.
LifeKit wants to help you succeed because everyone needs a little help being human.
It can seem so overwhelming. You're not alone.
Who can I commit to being?
If you want to do something, then just do it. Just take that first step.
Great advice every week. Listen to LifeKit from NPR.
From KUT and KUTX Studios.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
What I want everybody to know is that belonging matters, and belonging is community, and what you have created through the league and through all of these other amazing institutions that we as people of color, women, marginalized communities, hey, even men, we create belonging through our communities because we need it. It is an essential need for human beings to feel as though they belong. And so either you are going to create these communities that are healthy and thriving so that people feel as though they have place and purpose, or are you going to create negative, toxic environments that are going to breed the kind of toxicity that we're seeing in our society today, whether you look at it as some forms of elitism or separatism or criminal behavior, however you're going to, you know, look at it.
Michelle Miller, national correspondent, CBS News, co-host of CBS This Morning, and author of Belonging, A Daughter's Search for Identity Through Lost in Love, published by Harper. One would not believe that an Emmy and an Edward R. Murrow Award-winning journalist would feel abandoned, but that was just the case for Miller. As a child growing up in South Central Los Angeles, she would later learn that her father, the late Dr. Ross Miller, had an extramarital affair with Miller's mother, a hospital administrator. Although her father was the love of her mother's life, her grandparents weren't having it. Ultimately, Miller's mother was presented with either him or us ultimatum by her family. Her mother chose her family, which meant abandoning Miller. Belonging is a heart-wrenching story that tells how a child becoming a young woman found her space and place to overcome our childhood wounds. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Belonging, A Daughter's Search for Identity Through Loss and Love with Michelle Miller, In Black America.
When I met Michelle, and when you meet someone for the first time and you go through this get-to-know-you process, we, at some point, she said something to the effect, I need to tell you about something. And it was prefaced by saying, don't you ever abandon me. And at the time, I didn't quite know, because that's what she said without the context of the story of her mother. And then she said, I was going to Los Angeles for a business meeting. I was mayor at the time. And she said, please go see my dad. It's very important that you see my dad. And we had just really begun dating. And I said, I'll go see your dad. And she said, well, I want you to go see my dad, but you're going to have to go to St. Francis Hospital because he's in the hospital. He's ailing, and he may not make it because he had prostate cancer at the time. And I believe it was after that trip that I came back that Michelle told me her story.
Mark Moyell, Miller's husband of 23 years. Michelle Miller's story is a deeply personal story of her mother's abandonment and how the search for answers forced her to reckon with her own identity and the secret that shaped her life for five decades. Belonging chronicles Miller's decade-long quest to connect with the woman who gave her life, to confront her past, and ultimately to find a voice as a journalist, a wife, and a mother. Miller traces the years spent trying to make sense of her mixed race heritage and her place in a white-dominated world. As the daughter of a noted trauma surgeon, the late Ross Miller, Miller was able to rub elbows with celebrated African Americans. In her book, Miller looks back on her decades, reporting painful events from the beating of Rodney King to the death of George Floyd, revealing her own struggles to understand her racial identity coincides with the nation's own ongoing and imperfect racial reckoning. We caught up with Miller at the National Urban League Conference in Houston, Texas.
Michelle, why at this point in your life did you decide to write Belonging?
Opportunity. I had been threatening to write a book, pretending to write a book for 10 to 12 years, but not until a moment of access through work in which I was asked to cover the aftermath of the George Floyd murder and the social justice moment around his death. Did that opportunity sort of arise? And it was me engaging the story of what was happening. I thought of kind of the prism of change that we thought was taking place with, in the middle of lockdown, people engaging in the way that they were, that I expressed all of the brutality cases that I had covered and moments of unrest all the way back to 1992 and the LA uprising, which I lived through because I'm from South Central Los Angeles. Did I step out and lean into telling my story? And I told it in 15 seconds, and it went something like this. Racism has affected me all my life, born into the unrest of the 1960s. I was the product of a union between a father who adored me and a mother who to this day does not acknowledge my existence. And just that turn in the midst of everything else that I was saying, like struck a chord, struck a nerve. I don't know what I was expecting out of it, but literally the reaction from the audience, from Gail King, and from a publisher who had been watching at home, who emailed me 37 minutes later saying, that's a book and I'd love to publish it. So it was an opportunity through my engagement as a journalist, sort of unlocking my own or uncovering my own connection to what was happening in the George Floyd moment that allowed
an exposure to be seen, or to expose myself and expose my story in a way that it allowed other people to hear it, and there was a publisher listening.
Now, reading a book, one comes across some notable individuals that ordinarily one would not think growing up that you would cross paths with.
I know, right?
Right. Well, first of all, I was fascinated about Big Mama. She took you on in her 70s?
Yes.
Talk to us about her.
Man, you know, it's so crazy that I remember how much I don't remember about my grandmother. She was with me for 11 years before she moved back to Birmingham. She was a stoic, strong, quiet force that my father and my grandmother leaned on to many degrees, relied on heavily of, in terms of her conscience and her fortitude. But her to hear them talk about my grandmother, the person they knew was a funny, kick-ass kind of, you know, there was a connection to her wilder side that I never saw. She was always so stern and yet loving. It was an odd mix. She taught me how to read. You know, we would have great conversations, because I slept with my grandmother, I think, until I was about 6 years old. And I remember, like, her love of watermelon and salt. And when I would come to the table, it was almost like she was miserly with, you know, her, that was her afternoon delight. And I would sit there with my mouth wide open as if to feed me, I want some. You know, picking peaches off the backyard peach tree, making peach cobbler, her taking me to school every day, every Thursday going to either McDonald's or the Sloppy Joe place. You know, having that sort of routine. And then knowing now just how tough that must have been for a woman of her age. And certainly in a community where there, in that moment, there weren't a lot of children my age. And so I don't know how she knew she, you know, the greatest disappointment for me in my life is that my grandmother nor my father were able to see the level of success and the experiences that I have managed to experience. I know that I would have I just know that they would have been just overjoyed. And I think there's something about, like, the fruition, like, you when you pour into somebody and then you see on the other side, like, the benefit of all that sacrifice and that effort, there is nothing but joy that you have it pays off in dividends. And I don't know if they ever truly knew that it would.
I found it interesting that a lot of people don't know your dad was the physician who attended to Robert Kennedy when he was assassinated in Los Angeles. Talk to us about that.
Well, you know, it's so crazy.
Another hidden figure, so
yeah. Yeah. There are a lot of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, it's interesting because my husband's family is so prominent in New Orleans as the first black mayor. His father was certainly, I mean, he's legendary.
That's
so
right.
My children grew up going to New Orleans and knowing all about their grandfather, Dutch Morial. So when my husband was listening to a tape of Robert F. Kennedy, that was my endpoint to tell my children about, you know, their grandfather, my father, who had a moment, you know, in history. And when I told my 12-year-old son, Mason, he looked at me and said, "Mommy, I don't believe you. Prove it." And it was such an irreverent answer, and I was so stunned and angry that I ran to the computer. It wasn't the first time I think I had Googled something like that, but it was the first time, and it would have been like 45 years, right, that something popped up. So an FBI report, an LAPD report, both popped up, and there was a reference to my father. And the reference was, in exchange for a ride back from Good Samaritan Hospital to the Ambassador Hotel, Dr. Ross Miller granted an interview to two CBS News reporters. And my eyes like popped open. I would later discover that there were also NBC reporters that interviewed him. But the fact that I saw the CBS News reference was when I went to work the next day. And there was a producer who particularly heard me. I had just started working with him. And his name was Joneil Adriano. And he would listen to everything I would say and would like hear me. And I asked him, I felt confident in asking him, do you think that this interview still exists? And he said, it's worth a look. And I said, wow. So he went looking for it. And another broadcast associate named Anam Sadiq, who I just spent some time with working on a story, she poured over 7 hours of tape to find a 7-minute long interview that involved my dad. And it was just magic. I had never heard my father's voice with that tenor in it. I had never seen him look that young in an animated form. It was just like, it was so thrilling for me. And one of my closest friends at CBS News is Anthony Mason, who is a stellar journalist. And he, 3 months before, had done a story on his stepfather, who's still living, and his connection to John F. Kennedy. And the story goes that John F. Kennedy's sisters wanted to have a portrait or a painting done for all of their brothers of a seascape with a sailboat. And one day, one of the sisters came over to view the sketch. The day she viewed the sketch was the day that her brother John was assassinated. So it was like a moment, again, a tie to a point in history. And I remember asking him, what can I do with this tape? And he said, well, you got to find the people who were there. And I remember the story my dad would always tell me. I got to Robert Kennedy first. I could only make him comfortable. There was nothing more I could do for him. His vital signs were, you know, what they were. I believe he said steady, but not steady. He said they were elevated, but there were five other people shot that night. And the second person he got to, I remembered his name, Paul Schrade, because he would say it all the time. And there was another person he got to. So I found Paul Schrade, and I talked to Paul Schrade. And then I found the guy who's famous for all those pictures that are so infamous from that night. Do you know, it was a fascinating story, and I hope, you know, all of your listeners will check it out, will search for it. But what was so amazing in that moment, the fact that my son had dared me to find this story, to prove this story, 4 months after I did, the man who was the key to the ending of the piece passed away. So I think about that. And I stayed in touch with Paul for another 10 years. And I was so excited that I was writing this book. And Paul Schrade, I reached out to before I published it, couldn't get in touch with him. And about 3 weeks before the book came out, I discovered that he had passed away. So, you know, long story short, my dad's place in history is that he was a delegate of Robert F. Kennedy's. He worked with him in South Los Angeles, campaigned with him the day before and the day of his visit to South Los Angeles with the likes of Rosie Grier and Rafer Johnson, and was part of that amazing coalition of people that gathered at the Ambassador Hotel the night of June the 5th to celebrate in the California primary win. And no sooner does he get off of this, off the stage, having delivered this amazing triumphant speech, he's gunned down. And my dad is the first to get to him to see what could be done. And the irony in the book is, I didn't realize it at the time, but we were sort of piecing everything together, was I remember tales that my grandmother would tell about when she brought me back from Birmingham. Because remember, I was shipped to Birmingham at two days old to my aunt and her friend. And no one told my grandmother. And when my grandmother found out about it, she found out through my father because of Martin Luther King's assassination. Right. And the fact that I would land in Los Angeles from Birmingham at the moment that Robert Kennedy's body was being taken back on Air Force One, and we were at a stalled position because they were taking off, it sends like chills through me. It really does. You can't make this stuff up.
You can't make it up.
This is In Black America. We'll be back with more of our conversation in a moment.
This new year, LifeKit wants to help you succeed, because everyone needs a little help being human.
It can seem so overwhelming. You're not alone.
Who can I commit to being?
If you want to do something, then just do it. Just take that first step.
Great advice every week. Listen to LifeKit from NPR.
Now on with our conversation.
I also found interesting that your decision to attend Howard kind of mirrored my decision to go to an HBCU.
Where'd you go?
I went to Houston Tillerson College, Niles University in Austin, Texas. But I've never understood why the other races want to put their hands in our hair. So talk to us about that experience that actually had you deciding to go to a HBCU after the way you were treated, your three friends in high school.
That wasn't high school. That was actually elementary school. That was in the hood.
Okay.
That was three black girls, four mm-hmm. black girls, who ganged up on me, and for a reason that I think I said something that was, you know, it was, I didn't mean for it to be unkind, but it doesn't matter. The intent. And that's how it was played out. And I think about like how someone could be so angry with something you say, a comment you make about a hairstyle, and that reverberated, and that the anger, and that's just like further proof to me of just how insidious this sort of racial divide is when it comes to how racism has pent the colorism thing, the fact that people have like stratified worth based on hair texture and worth based on color of skin, worth, it's just all ridiculous, right? But yet people don't feel, they've been made to feel that they aren't pretty or they aren't worthy or whatever it is because of that. You know, it's just like, it's like such a sad commentary, but certainly it is part of the vestiges of the plantation mentality of slavery and how they divided and conquered so many people based on the color, based on the miscegenation that was taking place. It's just,
and you talk about that in the book.
I talk a lot about it, but it's not something that's easily explained in a soundbite, right?
Exactly.
It can be easily misinterpreted in a soundbite, and so it's something I don't like talking about because the context is, you've got to be really very, very clear about it. You know, and I'm not trying to absolve myself, but really, you got to understand the contextual nature of that sort of that colorism basis that stemmed out of a system of slavery.
A couple of more questions, Michelle. How do you navigate being the first lady of the National Urban League, but also being a national correspondent for CBS?
You know, it's funny. Well, you just laugh and look at you. You tickled, aren't you?
Yes.
No, so I think I'm really only first lady one week a year.
Okay.
Because you just laughing. What was so funny?
I just like to your answer that you
know. Well, no, I mean it's the truth because, you know, I am only first lady when I'm with my husband in a work setting.
Gotcha.
Because for the very reason why I wasn't first lady of the city of New Orleans in many mm-hmm. respects, because I was a journalist and I had to sort of walk
that
this
line. Right.
It's a fine line. And so I've chosen a profession that where I am, you know, I have to sort of be neutral. Not sort of be. I have to be neutral in a lot of in how I live. And so even like being married to someone who's so vocal about many things, many things that are going on is, I'm sure like people are looking at me in many strange ways, but I mean, you know, what are you going to do? It is what it is. And so, you know, I engage when I'm at conference, I engage through the Women of Power, I engage in uplifting amazing women. I engage in any, you know, duties that take advantage of the assets and the talents that I bring. But generally speaking, I don't get into policy mm-hmm. in front of audiences gotcha. In that way. It's tough to. It's a tough line to toe, but I want to be supportive of my husband, and I certainly want to be supportive of an organization that has done nothing but to support my community. I grew up in Los Angeles. I grew up in South Central Los Angeles. I grew up with the LA Urban League. Like, so I remember John Mack. He was one of our local heroes. So for people to say that, you know, I can't engage because these were good works for regular people, you know, I think I'm a human being first, and I'm going to make sure that people are taken care of. And so, yeah, so it's, but by and large, that's a short answer.
Michelle, final question. What do you want readers to come away with once they've read the book?
Well, I want them to understand that they're not alone. I mean, there's so many people who have origin stories that don't fit a narrative that is presumed to be quote unquote normal. And that anyone who doesn't fit into the box of this you know, family strata, that they aren't normal. And so, or they're made to feel less than. I mean, think about all of the words out there that describe people who are born out of wedlock, who are children of two different parents from different ethnic groups, different backgrounds. There's just such negativity in it, and I just want people to understand that, you know, you don't have to hide from the secrets that your family chose to keep. You don't have to hide, or you don't have to live in the shame that other people associate with how you came to be. You came to be. You are here. You belong. You matter. And I think that that's the takeaway for me, because, you know, you from scratch. From the moment you come out of the womb, you have this opportunity, and a lot of bad things can happen to you. It's what you choose to do with those bad things. You can always, there is nobody in this life that has not received help from someone who has made it to where they are of success. And I think that there's this artificial notion that you know, in order to be truly successful, you had to do it by yourself. And nobody's ever done it by themselves. And there's not always, we don't always live in a meritocracy. I mean, I just don't see it that way. There are too many people who are mediocre, who don't have college degrees, running Fortune 500 companies. I'm not saying that they aren't worthy, but what I'm saying is that, you know, there are a lot of people I question, you know, did they really earn that? And there, it is always thrown back on people who look, who quote unquote look or come from some place that isn't expected. They're always questioned. Well, I like throw the question back at those people who had easy access. Did you really earn it? Or did you just have easy access? Did you, were you at third base and pretended like you hit a triple? Or you know, like let's be real. You started at third base. Meanwhile, I had to hit a triple to get to third base. And I think there, and that goes across many different lines. But I just want people to understand that, you know, don't let anybody box you in, you know, and understand that you are special and belong and matter. I think that's the basic tenet, and you can create whatever you want. Oftentimes, if you ask for help, and if you get it, and if you move forward and stay positive. There are a whole lot of little lessons in there, but pivot. Setback is nothing but a setup for a comeback.
Michelle Miller, national correspondent, CBS News, co-host of CBS This Morning, and author of Belonging, A Daughter's Search for Identity Through Loss and Love. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchive.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm John L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
This new year, LifeKit wants to help you succeed because everyone needs a little help being human.
It can seem so overwhelming. You're not alone.
Who can I commit to being?
If you want to do something, then just do it. Just take that first step.
Great advice every week. Listen to LifeKit from NPR.
From KUT and KUTX Studios.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
It is important as mayors that we maintain and even enhance our connection to the people that we serve. We have to become our best communicators. And what I have learned over the last 8 years as mayor is that I have to be out there talking directly to the people. I have to be amongst them and tell what we are doing, listen to them, be accessible to them, and then hope that they too become your ambassadors. And so when they are seeing or reading stories, they themselves can say, that's not true.
Mayor Sylvester Turner of Houston, Texas. This past summer, the city of Houston played host to the National Urban League Annual Conference. The conference brought together major leaders from the business, government, and social advocacy sectors, and served as a center for policymakers, political activists, and others to meet and exchange ideas, network, and develop strategies to address a broad range of issues. The National Urban League is a historic civil rights organization dedicated to economic empowerment in order to elevate the standard of living in historically underserved urban communities. The organization spearheads the efforts of its 92 local affiliates through the development of program, public policy, research, and advocacy, providing direct services that impact and improve the lives of more than 2 million people annually nationwide. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, the African-American mayors of the nation's four largest cities in Black America.
Well, you know, following up on what you were saying, I believe that in our communities, we've worked for years and know the strategies to intervene and prevent crime. There's always the rap that Black folks are upset if it's a law enforcement involved death, but say nothing when it's Black on Black, which I reject that notion. That is not true. But unfortunately, the grassroots work that happens in all of our communities is never lifted up, and we need to invest more in that. When we went through the time period of mass incarceration, which is not like it's over, but it's a little bit different now, you know, laws were passed to lock us up for everything under the sun, including what I believe were health, social, and economic issues that should not have required incarceration.
Mayor Karen Bass of Los Angeles, California. The first two African-American mayors were elected in 1868, the year the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution was adopted. However, it would take another 100 years for an African-American to be elected mayor of a large U.S. city. In 1970, Newark, New Jersey, and Dayton, Ohio, both elected African-American Democrats as mayors. During the 1970s, cities like Tallahassee, Cincinnati, Detroit, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and New Orleans elected their first African-American mayors. Today, more than one-third of America's top 100 cities are governed by African-Americans, many of them men, women. Also today, the four largest cities in America are led by African-American mayors. This past summer, the National Urban League held its annual conference in Houston, Texas. On the second day of the conference, President and CEO Mark Morial held a fireside chat with Mayor Sylvester Turner of Houston, Mayor Eric Adams of New York City, Mayor Karen Bass of Los Angeles, California, and Mayor Brandon Johnson of Chicago, Illinois.
Ladies and gentlemen, first time on stage, these four represent experience, power, and promise. So let's give it up for these four great mayors of major American cities. Now, Mayor Turner.
Yes, sir.
You're the OG here now. Brother Turner, because of this thing called term limits, you don't have them in Chicago.
Don't even bring it up.
But Mayor Turner, I think it's helpful as you reflect on your time in office and the journey and the struggles and the travails. What wisdom and advice would you impart to our colleagues this morning?
Look, being mayor is unlike many other things. There are certain things we plan, we lay out, we come in with certain priorities, and we map them out. But it's the things you have not planned for that you have to deal with. And then there are things that happen that are not under your control, where you may have to work with, for example, the state, and the state may not want to work with you, or you have to work with the feds. But my advice is, number one, you can't do it all by yourself. This is a team effort, and so you have to have the right people around you. And you have to have people who are capable, competent, highly qualified, but people who are also dedicated to you.
Loyal.
And loyal. Because you can have the best people, and they can be smart, but if they're not loyal, it does not work.
You said something.
And so, yeah.
You mean smart but stupid.
And so you can't hold on to those where you can check the box, but when people show you that they are not rowing in the same direction, you do what we do, and you call them in at 4 o'clock on a Friday, and you thank them for their service. But their season here has passed.
It's over. Close the door. Thank you. Let's give Mayor Turner a round of applause. He's been a great, incredible. Mayor Bass, You're 6 months in now?
Seven.
7 months in? Good to see you still smiling. Did you make the right decision by leaving a safe, comfortable seat in Congress to run for mayor of Los Angeles?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. And you know, and it wasn't that I was tired of Congress at all. I mean, I love being in Congress. I love the work, especially the work on Africa. But our folks were dying. Our folks are dying on the streets of Los Angeles. We got 46,000 people sleeping in tents. Black folk are 8% of the city, 34% of the people in tents. What I was worried about was that we were getting ready to repeat the 90s and criminalize those folks. And so I feel very, very good because we cannot repeat history. People on the street need help. They need housing. They need health care. And if I can play a role in that, wherever it is, I'm thrilled to be there and to take on the challenge.
Good. Mayor Bass of Los Angeles, Mayor Adams, and I get a chance to watch the mayor every day because I'm in New York, so I watch him, and he's brought a dynamism and a leadership. And a, you know, one of the things about being mayor, you got to let everybody know you're in charge. You got to let everybody know that the buck stops at your desk. Mayor, now about, what, 18 months roughly?
Yes.
In, what's the biggest surprise you've encountered in that 18-month period being mayor of New York?
That's a great question. You know, and I say this over and over again, that, you know, people say being the mayor of the New York City is the second most difficult job in America. And I say, when does the hard part start? Because I know what hard is. Hard is picking cotton from sunup to sundown, yeah, delivering your baby in the field and going back. Hard is watching people jump over you in promotions when you dedicated your life. Hard is what my mother did, raising six children with being really abandoned and betrayed by government. Hard is being a little black child growing up, being dyslexic, then being arrested. And I like to say being rejected, but now I'm elected to be the mayor of the city of New York. So I know what hard is. I know what hard is. I wake up every day with a clear agenda, and I'm not going to be distracted. And you're not going to spend the time that I was running for office trying to degrade me, and then you want to pick my staff and tell me who to hire. I'm going to hire competent people who have my vision rowing in my direction. That is why, first time in history, I hired a black police commissioner. I hired a Hispanic to run my correctional facility. I hired the first African-American, first deputy mayor, first Indian-American to be a deputy mayor, first Filipino-American to be a deputy mayor, first Korean-American to be in charge of small business services, first African-American, first Trinidadian woman deputy mayor. I picked my team that's reflective of the city. If you want to be on my team, you have to have gone through a lot so you could help people who are going through a lot. That is how you run a city. And brother, we're running it. We're running it. You know, people are blown away with all that we inherited. Remember, January 1st, 2022, I inherited COVID. We navigated through that. Now I have 91,000 asylum seekers in my city, can't work. I have to feed, clothe, house, educate their children, and we're doing it. The bond raters who determined where you invest your money gave me a double A rating because of how I'm managing the city. You're seeing competent leadership. So the only surprise that I have is, why is it taking the national media so long to determine that black mayors can run city and they
Amen.
Can run it right?
Amen. Amen. Amen.
Now I had to get out of my seat on that one.
Amen. Yes, sir. And Mayor Johnson, when I see you, I can't help but think of the legend, Harold Washington, who was a pace setter, an inspiration for me, and one who inspired me to seek the mayor's office in New Orleans. Chicago has been longing for the spirit and the fight of Harold Washington since his untimely death in 1987. As you begin and as you think, how is Harold Washington's
time, a guide, an inspiration for you?
Well, thank you. That's a good question. And had I known we would have a sanctified crowd this morning.
You at the Urban League, brother.
Saying, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what I was thinking. Of course, it's a sanctified crowd. but I'm grateful here. I want to thank, you know, Mayor Turner and Bass and Adams for their leadership and direction. The text messages, the calls of concern and hope have been a tremendous inspiration and has helped balance me through these first 11 weeks. You know, when you grow up and you've experienced the 80s, you know, you hear from your father, your grandfather, your uncles and aunts, you know, about a time of promise and hope. And Chicago is rich in legacy, right? And so I would be remiss if I did not acknowledge Chairman Fred, who said healthcare for all.
Yeah.
He said every child should eat before they go to school, right? That comes out of the Black Panther Party ideology and movement that was birthed on the west side of Chicago where I live, right? And when I think about, of course, the time that Dr. King spent on the west side of Chicago, and he understood the importance of the civil rights movement and the labor rights movement, and understanding that that collision had enormous potential. And he said that the rights of labor and the fight for civil rights are one and the same. The enemy of the Negro is the enemy of labor. And so then, of course, you have this ushering in of Black liberation through the election of Mayor Harold Washington. And it was, of course, 40 years ago that a Black mayor said sanctuary city. You know, I'm not sure if he knew that this day would come, but somehow he understood the prophetic assignment that he had. And so now, you know, when I'm moving through the streets of Chicago, the one thing that I do appreciate about Black folks, especially Black people, is that our hopes and aspirations are tied and linked to one another. And we are very clear that we didn't get here alone.
Amen.
And I'm glad that we serve a God that doesn't drop us off along the way. And so
how you gonna
when
preach?
I think about, so, I mean, since y'all doing it, you know, so just as a disclaimer, I was raised in the Church of God in Christ. So see, there's always a couple of Kojic people here.
Yeah.
So
sanctified.
This conference, this panel just got 1 hour longer.
Yeah. We gonna keep on going.
But the point though is that these moments don't leave us behind. These moments propel us forward. And so it's a reflection of the incredible resilience of our ancestors. And I'm glad that I get to stand on the shoulders of those who have been here before.
So I learned when I served as mayor of New Orleans from 94 to 02. When I took office, I was the first person elected in some 60 years that did not have the endorsement of the local newspaper. It was definitional. Because from the very beginning, what the local newspaper did is they put a team of reporters on me, one to play nice and one to play nasty. The one that played nice tried to make friends. The one that played nasty was looking in garbage cans. And this is important for Black mayors, right? And I really want, and every city's a little bit different. You know, the way, but mayors now and elected officials now have an independent channel
to be able to talk
to people. Right. And I think what I'd like each of you to maybe address, Mayor Bass, we can go first, a little bit about how you think about the importance of the media and communicating with the public, because it's important for constituents to understand that it is absolutely abundantly clear that Black mayors don't get treated the same. Period, time after time, example after example. No matter what you do, you could have an S on your chest. You could leap tall buildings in a single bound. But how do you think about that from a Los Angeles perspective?
Well, and you know, we can talk race, but also add in gender. I will talk about it. Because that's a dynamic as well. When I started, the whole way I was being framed was, well, is she going to be like Eric Garcetti, the previous mayor? As though I had done nothing before. I'd been in Congress, I'd been in the state legislature,
and I served as Speaker
of the House, but was I going to be him? But, you know, to me, I mean, my background and my root and my heart is as a community organizer. And so, to me, communication means communicating on every single level. And the grassroots level is critically important. And that social media helps with that, but not enough. I mean, you have to get out and talk to people. You have to provide every kind of forum and vehicle. One of the things that we did in Congress that I plan to do in the city was telephone town halls. So I used every vehicle, in-person town halls, telephone town halls, social media. But one of the things that makes social media tough is that anybody can call themselves media and a newspaper. And so what I'm finding, and I'm sure my three colleagues up here are finding too, you'll have crazy news sources do an article that just make up stuff. And then 3 days later, quote unquote, mainstream newspapers or radio will pick it up. And then it becomes a legitimate story. But I think it's very important to be proactive. It's very important to have your own frame, but your own analysis, not just a soundbite, but an analysis about what it is that you're talking about. Because I believe that one of the most important things about communication is education. It's not just making, you know, a statement or a slogan or a soundbite, but what is it that you're trying to say that is consistent with your values and my values rooted in social and economic justice?
Thank you very much, Mayor Bass.
We'll be back with more In Black America after this message.
This new year, LifeKit wants to help you succeed. Because everyone needs a little help being human.
It can seem so overwhelming. You're not alone.
Who can I commit to being?
If you want to do something, then just do it. Just take that first step.
Great advice every week. Listen to Life Kit from NPR.
And now back to this episode of In Black America.
Mayor Turner, again, asking you to reflect on what's worked well when it comes to your ability to communicate to the citizens of Houston. What is it that you may know now that you wish you understood better when you started on the issue of communicating with the public?
Well, I mean, it is important as mayors that we maintain and even enhance our connection to the people that we serve. We have to become our best communicators. And what I have learned over the last 8 years as mayor, is that I have to be out there talking directly to the people. I have to be amongst them and tell what we are doing, listen to them, be accessible to them, and then hope that they too become your ambassadors. And so when they are seeing or reading stories, they themselves can say, that's not true. And I have had people as I've gone throughout the city, after they have read something or heard something, they will say, Mayor, we know that's not true. So we have to be out there. But I'm constantly reminded what my mom said in growing up, and then she said, life is not fair, but you still have to learn Amen. To navigate through it. And so we have to be very careful that we don't become so obsessed with the negativity that we lose focus. When I first came in as mayor, the city had been facing a pension problem for some 20-some years. And right there on the front of the paper, it said, Mayor must fix the pension problem now. And I said, hell, I just got here. But it was, I have to fix it. But we fixed it. And so a pension problem that was $8.2 billion when we came in is now less than $2.2 billion and going down. But what I've also discovered is that you have media that will flash a camera on the problem, but they don't give you much credit on the success. And then the ball keeps moving. You fix this and this comes up. The last point that I will make, we just did this trade and investment mission to Africa. In my 8 years, you know, we have gone